calling. So, Dr. Berry, how does this week look?
Good morning. I have some good news on the COVID front, so that is hopeful. We continue to see case rates downtrend at the national and state level. We do, unfortunately, continue to see a very large number of American citizens dying due to COVID-19 every day. We're losing approximately 1,100 citizens due to COVID-19 every day at this point. That is down from our peak, but it does highlight the ongoing severity of the infection, particularly for those who are not vaccinated. In Washington state, case rates continue to downtrend. And locally, our case rates have downtrended to the point that we are now at the low risk threshold, wherein most people can safely unmask in indoor spaces. So currently in Jefferson County, we have diagnosed 3,145 cases of COVID-19. That puts us at a case rate of 71 per 100,000 with a 2.9% positivity. We are going to move to updating that twice weekly at the request of many members of our community who want to see that case rate updated a little more frequently. So that'll be updated on Tuesdays and Fridays going forward. We have two of our residents currently hospitalized for a total of 115 hospitalizations so far in this response. And we have lost 28 of our citizens to COVID-19. We have had no new deaths since the last time we spoke. In Clallam County, we've diagnosed 10,913 cases of COVID-19, and the case rate in Clallam County has also dropped below the 100 threshold to 80 cases per 100,000 in the last 2 weeks, with an also very low percent positivity at 2.4. So we are truly seeing lower rates of transmission in our region. We do think we have a low enough rate of COVID-19 transmission in our region right now that it is reasonable and safer to go ahead and unmask in indoor spaces if you are low risk for severe disease. We do recommend that those who are at high risk for severe disease, which is a decent proportion of our community, continue to mask until we get below that 50 cases per 100,000 threshold. But right now in Jefferson County, we are on track to do that by this next Friday. So we'll continue to monitor the numbers over the next few days, but we do think that we're likely to get there in the near future. We are closely following the situation in the UK, which is starting to get some more kind of press attention. We are seeing significant case rises and also hospitalizations rise in the UK, which tends to predate what will happen in the United States by about a month or so. In the UK, cases are up 79%, hospitalizations are up 40%. We think the primary drivers of that are a few. So one is they are seeing an increased percentages of the BA2 subvariant, which is more contagious than the Omicron variant that we've experienced here. We don't currently have any evidence of increased severity of that variant, but it does transmit even more readily than the BA1 Omicron variant that we know here. We also saw that the UK relaxed all of their mitigation measures simultaneously, and we do think that is also driving this rise. There is also the possibility that there is some waning immunity, both from vaccination and from prior infection that we're seeing play out in the UK. And that's part of what is driving the conversation about considering a fourth dose for the high risk of the vaccine. We don't yet have the data to support that, but we are looking at that data right now. Pfizer and Moderna have submitted for possible authorization for a fourth dose of their vaccines. And we'll see that data in much more detail soon. The first FDA advisory committee meeting to look over that data is on the 30th of March. And so we'll all be following that conversation very closely. But right now, the best and most important thing you can do to keep yourself safe from COVID-19 is to get your full course of COVID-19 vaccines, which for most of us is three. So to get your first two and then to get your booster as well. If you are immunosuppressed, we do recommend you get a fourth dose, but that's the only group we recommend fourth doses for right now. Just a quick touch base on masking. I think there is a lot of conversation around this right now, and this is a big time of transition for us. I do think it is reasonable when case rates are low to unmask in indoor spaces. But I think it is important to remember that COVID-19, as we're seeing in the UK and in other parts of the world, is not over. We will likely see a rise in cases again in our region, probably in the next month or two. And so don't throw that mask away, but it is okay to take it off for right now. Follow the case thresholds. When we see those case rates come back up, which we likely will, we recommend folks put it back on. The good news about COVID-19 is that we know much better how to prevent its transmission and how to prevent severe disease. The best thing we can do is get vaccinated. After that, the next best thing we can do is to wear masks in indoor settings when case rates are high. If we do those two things alone, we could dramatically blunt any subsequent surge that we're going to have. I think it is important to acknowledge that COVID is not gone, but it's also equally important to acknowledge that we have the tools to manage any surges that come our way. I don't want our community to panic. I think this is something that we can manage. We just all have to follow the data, and we all have to follow these recommendations, or at least a lot of us do. If a lot of us follow these recommendations, we can really blunt any future surges in our community. And so with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the commissioners.
I have one. At times we have talked about case rate not being the best way to kind of track, especially with these very contagious variants and with so many people vaccinated in our community, not at risk of severe disease. Is it still the best proxy we have, especially given our small population? Or do you anticipate that we would move to talking more about hospitalization rates?
I think we'll continue to track both. And in truth, we often publicize the case rate, but we follow the hospitalization rate internally as well. The trouble is that hospitalizations generally do trail after case rates. And so if we wait until the hospitals are having a problem, we're way too late. But I think looking at case rates, looking at hospitalization rates, and also looking at things like wastewater surveillance, which we're starting to see in some parts of the United States actually show an uptick already. We're not seeing that. We do have a little bit of surveillance in Clallam County, and also some surveillance in our neighboring counties, and we're not seeing an uptick in Washington State yet. I think we'll continue to look at all three. None of these measures are perfect. Case rates are certainly not perfect, but I do think they provide a good proxy for the risk in our community, at least right now. Unlike many other jurisdictions, we do count our antigen tests, and a lot of people report them. And so we keep pretty good track of case rates in our region. We also provide a lot of the antigen tests to the community, which is a little different than a lot of other places. And so we have a little bit better handle on the current situation based on not just how many people are calling us, but how many tests are going out. If we see a sudden surge in demand and people who are trying to get tests, usually that suggests a lot of people are sick right now, and we can do a little more work to try to figure out what's going on. So we'll still track it. Case rates are still probably, as an individual citizen, the best thing you can look at for your risk in an indoor space. That tells you the probability that other people have COVID there. Hospitalizations tell us whether or not the system as a whole is in danger, but for you to make your own decisions about how you navigate your life, case rates are really still your best measure.
Great, thank you.
Dr. Berry, I'm curious how you interact with the schools. I think you mentioned on last week's call that you were having a meeting with the schools, or had I just met with the schools. And I attended the Empowered Teens Coalition for Chimicum last week, and much of our conversation was about kind of the kids' reaction to the changing landscape of masking. And so I'm just wondering what you're hearing out there in both Jefferson and Clallam counties from school leaders.
Sure. So I have a regular meeting. My primary point of contact is with our superintendents. So we meet up to weekly, sometimes more frequently when things are really, really speedy. But often we speak every 2 weeks with the superintendents, and then they can reach out if issues come up. I have, especially when there's big changes, met with individual teachers as well. So we'll get a Zoom call, and just all the teachers can come and bring all their questions. I have had a couple really positive meetings with students as well, and I'm always happy to do more of that. Primarily, I've had outreaches from students in the Clallam County area. But I'm happy to meet with student leaders in Jefferson County as well. What I'm hearing among students is really a mix. I think the challenge is, as for kids in particular, clarity of expectations is really helpful. When they're not quite sure what they're supposed to do or what other people around them are going to do, that just leads to more anxiety and stress. And so one of the big challenges I've been hearing is just kids aren't sure what they're supposed to do. And they're not sure what their friends are gonna do or what it's gonna be like if they go to school. I hear from kids who want to unmask and who are worried kids are gonna mess with them if they unmask. I hear from kids who wanna wear a mask and who are worried they're gonna get bullied if they wear a mask. I hear concern from all ends. And so I would say, as the adults in these kids' lives, one of the biggest things you can do to help them navigate this is be clear about your own expectations. So as a parent, as a teacher, it's okay and appropriate to talk about our case rates and what we recommend right now. Right now, it is reasonable to unmask in indoor spaces, but remember, there are some of us who are high risk who are going to keep masking. And then really just sit with that child and hear their thoughts and their concerns and make space for them. I think that is the biggest. Kids need to feel heard and they need to feel supported in their decision making. By and large, I have heard from really impressively eloquent kids in both of our counties who really care about their neighbors and who really care about not bringing COVID home to their families. So I think the more that we create space for that and are clear with them about why changes are happening and when they're happening, the easier it is to navigate these times.
Thank you. And then the last question I've been hearing a lot from people, last question I have for you today is, how long are we going to continue our updates with you? A lot of people have come to rely on these for their touch point each week on, you know, where we're at as a community. And I don't know if there's any consideration of how long we continue doing these meetings with you. I would vote for forever, but probably the topic areas would change, hopefully. We would talk about other public health, issues in our community, but I'm just curious if you've had any consideration of that.
I mean, it's certainly come up in my mind as well. I think the primary driver is interest of our commissioners, time of our commissioners, how much time you want to set aside for this, and interest in the community. So if we're still getting lots of questions from the KPTZ listeners, that suggests people still want us to do this, and I'd be happy to do it. I think it is a really good outlet and a way to make us available and accessible for people to send in questions for us to answer on air. And I'm happy to, as time goes forward, potentially change the cadence of this, if that makes sense, or change the topics. So there are lots of public health topics we're actually all working on right now in the background, and we can talk about that too.
Great.
I have a question, although Willie, I'm curious if you want to weigh in on that at all. And maybe this is something we could talk about in policy management group also, but did you want to weigh in at all on the continuing this conversation?
I'm right there with Dr. Berry, more than happy to be here. I have been getting a couple of questions in recent times, so I'm happy to keep that up and continue to answer those. And we do, just like in public health, we do have plenty of going on in the emergency management and disaster preparedness world. I'd be more than happy to chat about here. So I certainly think we should look at starting to decrease the regularity of these a little bit and decrease frequency. But again, there's so much we can talk about. I think there are so many questions out there. I think we owe it to the citizens at least to have these touch points every so often at the very least. So more than happy to maintain that.
Great, thank you. And I have one more question, Dr. Berry. Thank you so much for presenting to the chamber last week. I heard it went really well. Were there kind of concerns from the business community that you heard, or just curious? You know, we're always interested in how the business community is doing. What impacts are they feeling? What concerns do they have? Can you summarize any takeaways from that meeting?
Yeah, I really appreciated the opportunity to speak to the chamber, and I agree. I think it was a really positive meeting. A lot of the questions were actually really similar to what we talk about here. So just basic questions about the virus and how to stay safe. It's always of interest to figure out how we can get our message out better, because some of them are similar questions to what we talk about on KPTZ. So I think reaching that audience directly was important. One of the more common questions I got was around keeping staff safe. So business owners who have individuals who work for them who are high risk, who want to figure out how to keep them in employment and protect them as people start to unmask. We also talked a little bit about navigating the challenge of folks who really don't want to mask if you are requiring masks in your space. And by and large, just a lot of empathy among the entire room that we've all had challenges in that area, myself included. That was most of what the questions were about. And then just a little bit of forecasting like we do here as well about what to look forward to and what we could imagine on the horizon.
Thank you.
By and large, I think most people were happy with where we are, but a little bit of concern around unmasking And how to navigate that transition and all the strong feelings that exist around masking in our community.
Yeah, I think we're all having a lot of those same conversations. Yes.
Okay. Well, I know I saw some questions come in from KPTZ listeners, so let's get to those.
So we got a few questions this go round. One person asked, do we already have the new variant here? And by that, I think you probably mean BA2, which is the subvariant of Omicron. We have had our first case of BA2 diagnosed in Clallam County. We've not had one diagnosed in Jefferson yet. Of interest, the person who was diagnosed actually travels to Kitsap for healthcare. And so not surprising that that would be one of the first places that we see BA2 show up. So we are likely starting to see it here. Remember, sequencing always trails about 2 weeks before we get those results back. But in Washington state as a whole, we're seeing about 9% of our specimens are coming back BA2. So it's far from the dominant variant here, but we are seeing it slowly increase in our region. Interestingly, it's not increasing as quickly as it is in other parts of the world. In Washington state, it's still really primarily BA1, and it's only going up a little bit each week. It was 6% of our specimens the week prior and 9% now. So it will likely overtake BA1 because it is more transmissible by our current data, but it's not dramatically overtaking in the way that Omicron overtook Delta. This person says, I have a choice to make. I can potentially be exposed to COVID 2 months after my booster shot, or I can wait to be potentially exposed 6 months after my booster shot. What is the safer choice? So it sounds like this person is trying to make some risk decisions, probably around a trip or some other kind of indoor gathering. I would say the boosters are still holding up really well against severe disease, but as far as preventing any infection at all, the closer you get to that 2 week mark after you got your booster, not immediately, wait 2 weeks, but after 2 weeks after your booster, that's the time that it is the most active in your body. So sooner rather than later is actually a good time. And now is a time where case rates are low in the United States. So if you're thinking about traveling in the United States, for example, now's actually a really good time to do it. I do still recommend wearing a mask on planes. It is still required to wear a mask on planes. And I recommend you wear one in the airport as well. But other than that, now is actually probably a good time. And I think the more that we can all get comfortable with that cadence, the more manageable this will be. So when case rates are low is a good time to meet up with friends, come indoors, plan a trip, so that you can get that kind of experience. And then when case rates are really high, take a little pause and come back. This person's asking about BA2. So apparently BA2 is increasing in many parts of Asia, the EU and the UK. And they said they have heard very little commentary about this. Is this being discussed in the US as a real and future threat? If not, why not? So it is being discussed in the US. It's something that we're monitoring very closely. I think what we're seeing in much of the rest of the world, it really varies depending on the country, what is driving the problem. So in much of East Asia, there was a intense zero COVID policy, which was very intense mitigations, not as much vaccination. And so once Omicron got in there, it's spreading like wildfire and it's hitting a lot of elderly folks who weren't vaccinated. So when you look at the significant rise in hospitalizations and deaths in Hong Kong in particular, that's largely due to the low vaccination rate of their elders that's driving that. The EU and the UK in particular are really good proxies for the United States. And so what we're seeing in the UK is likely to happen here, though, as we've noted on this program before, their policies are different than ours. They're not requiring isolation. They've not been funding testing. We're planning to try to blunt our wave by not doing that, by making sure there's testing available and making sure that we have good contact tracing and support for those who are positive. Back when we were in the midst of the Omicron wave, we couldn't contact trace the way we used to. We can now. And so if you are positive, we do want you to let us know. You can put it in online in a little smart sheet that's protected if you go to the Jefferson County Public Health website, or you can give us a call and we can help give you guidance, make sure that the virus doesn't spread beyond you. This person is turning 70 this year with their partner. They're both healthy, vaxxed, and boosted, and we will continue to wear masks in indoor settings. Is a person over 65 still considered to be high risk? Does high risk mean that we are more susceptible to contracting the virus, or does it mean that we are more likely to get really sick if we get it, or both? So those over 65 are still considered high risk for COVID-19. The primary risk there is risk of severe disease. We all can get COVID pretty equally. Age doesn't determine your probability of getting COVID. In fact, we tend to see more infection among those in their 20s and 30s because they're out and about and have a lower vaccination rate than those over 65. So the best protection you can have for yourself against severe disease is getting vaccinated and boosted as you have. And so that does dramatically reduce your risk of severe disease. Even now, even months after you got your booster, it still makes a big difference. But we do still consider those over 65 high risk. So I would still recommend wearing a mask in indoor settings until we get our case rates just a little bit lower. It's true that those over 65, there's a broad spectrum of health. So if you're just over 65 and have nothing else going on, you're vaccinated, you're boosted, you're relatively low risk of severe disease. But if you're over 65, you've got underlying significant chronic health diseases, COPD, hypertension, heart failure, things like that, then I really want you to wear a high quality mask in indoor spaces, because those are the things that set you up for a lot of trouble if you contract COVID-19. This person says, we are Port Townsend residents, 80 and 75 years old. We have no serious medical conditions, but we understand the age of our immune systems itself give us a risk for COVID. We are vaccinated and boosted as of November and continue to wear masks in public indoor spaces. We will be traveling to Europe in May for a family commitment. We would like to get the second booster because we see no downside and only positive. How can we go about requesting that? So I would say right now, if you don't have an underlying immunosuppressing condition, you are not yet eligible for a fourth dose. But on March 30th, the FDA is considering the possibility of expanding authorization for a fourth dose for those 65 and up. Depending what we see in the data, it is very possible that that authorization will come through. So if you're traveling in May, if they do recommend it, if the data supports it, you'll have the option of getting it before May. But we've got to look at the data to see whether or not it's needed. Many vaccines that we had in childhood are 3 or 4 dose series. So it's not uncommon at all to need 4 doses of something to have a prolonged immune response, but we'll need to see the data to know for sure what we recommend. So hang tight, totally understand the desire. We don't quite have it yet.
Can I ask a quick follow-up to that, Dr. Berry?
Yeah, please.
Would you anticipate that recommendation being based solely on age? So 65 and up could potentially be eligible, or any prognosis as to what that recommendation would look like?
I'd say the most likely will be age. We could also see other groups with significant underlying chronic conditions added in, like we've seen when we've had the first booster round. The first recommendation was for those who were over 65, and then kind of a less intense recommendation, but a possibility for those who have significant underlying conditions who are younger. So that's the way I could probably see it going, depending on what we see on the data. Looking at kind of early reports, we are seeing some decreased efficacy for preventing any disease, but so far not seeing decreased efficacy for preventing severe disease. And that's the big trigger that causes a fourth dose. So we will see when we get more access to that data. How can we tell when an N95 or a KN95 is used up? Should we keep track of the hours we've worn it? So the best way to tell if a KN95 or an N95 is used up is you aren't getting a tight seal on your face anymore. So a KN95 that fits you well should actually fold in a little bit when you breathe. If it's stopped doing that, or if it's kind of grossly contaminated, if it's gotten dirty, that's a signal that it's time to take it off. We have studied this in the clinical setting back when we didn't have enough masks, and you can use an N95 or a KN95 for 5 days, 5 12-hour shifts. So roughly 60 hours in your mask. So if you're just using it for, you know, a half hour or an hour trip and then taking it off, you can roughly think of how many of those you're having a day. Depending on how many trips you're doing, you could see your KN95 actually last up to a month, but it really depends on how you're using it. If you're using it for an entire day, for an entire shift, you really don't want to go more than 5 days with that mask before you switch in a new one. One last question, then we'll pass it over to Willie. If someone who is fully vaccinated and boosted gets a breakthrough COVID infection, can they in turn infect someone who is also fully vaccinated and boosted? Yes, but it is less likely. So when you are vaccinated and boosted, you're less likely to contract COVID. You're also less likely, if you are unfortunate enough to contract it, to pass it on to others. There's a couple reasons for that. One is that we see actually less pre-symptomatic transmission in those who are vaccinated and boosted. You develop symptoms very quickly before your viral load has spiked. And so it's much easier to isolate before you've given it to anybody else. We also see generally shorter viral, high viral loads in those who are vaccinated and boosted. So you have a shorter window to give it to other people. And we see lower rates of subsequent transmission to that boosted person. So it can happen, but it is less likely to happen. The most important thing to do if you get sick is get tested right away so you know whether or not you have COVID-19. And then for things like your household contacts, people who live with you, to wear a mask when you're in the same space with each other. And when you're in common areas that you know they're going to come into later, that makes a huge difference in reducing subsequent transmission in your household. But you already did the biggest, most important thing, which is getting everyone in your household vaccinated and boosted. All right, I will pass it over to Willie.
Thank you, thank you. Not much in the way of COVID updates this week. And in fact, the one question that I did get had nothing to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. So it goes back to a little bit what we were talking about earlier and maybe addressing some other public health emergency management related topics. This question specifically was related to the summer months and the heat waves that we experienced last summer and that we're likely to continue to experience as the climate continues to change. And specifically about the availability of quote, cooling centers during those heat waves. This individual noted that in Port Townsend during the first, the heat dome, as they called it in June, there wasn't a cooling center available in the city of Port Townsend. And so during that initial heat wave that was predicted to be 100 plus degrees down in South County, and then it was only going to be mid-80s in the city in Port Townsend. So OLECAP was gracious enough to open up cooling centers at their community centers in Chimacum, Quilcene, and Brennan. So during that first initial heat wave, there was a cooling center just 15 minutes away from town. I know folks like to, you know, stay where they are and have things relatively close by, but that was available just a short short drive away. However, during the second heat wave in the summer, we had noted some of the feedback from residents who had said, you know, that was a little bit far out of the way. They'd like things a little bit closer. And so the senior center in Port Townsend was available as a place to go to get out of the heat. The individual who wrote this question specifically noted that although it was, you know, mid-80s in town during that heat wave, it was well over triple digits in her third floor apartment. So having access to that resource was particularly important to her. So moving forward, we will be looking at having those options at, you know, as many locations as possible, as close by to folks as possible. It is a little bit difficult because a lot of places in Port Townsend don't have air conditioning. It was never a historical need, the courthouse being a great example of that. So a little bit difficult not having air conditioning in a lot of places. Now that we're moving out of the COVID-19 pandemic, it will make being able to safely congregate a little bit easier for folks. So that takes away one particular wrinkle. With regards to transportation, that was one issue this individual noted as well, specifically on Sundays when buses aren't running. So prior to this summer season, we will be talking with a few of our partners regarding transportation options, again, specifically on Sunday when those options are most limited, to be able to help get folks to where they need to go if they do want to access one of those resources. Do have to give a big shout out to OLECAP for running three of those cooling centers, again, in Chimacum, in Quilcene, in Brennan this past summer. And so we're really hoping that resource will be available during any heat wave again this summer. I will make a request of folks, though, sign up for our NCSL text alert service. You can do that on our website, jeffcoeoc.org. We mostly text you when there's been an accident and there's road closure for an extended period of time, when there's a tsunami advisory, for example. But if there is going to be a significant heat wave and there will be cooling centers available, we'll communicate that using that Nixle text subscription service. So sign up for that to be able to stay informed. That's when we'll send where those cooling centers are, what transportation resources might be available, et cetera. So definitely go and sign up for that, have that information at your fingertips. The other thing I will say as well is knowing that this is likely going to be happening more often, or is at least a little bit greater of a potential. I certainly don't expect everyone in the community to go out and install a brand new HVAC system in their home, but there are some pretty cheap and ingenious ways to be able to cool your home. You buy a $20 box fan and have plastic bottles filled with ice behind it. Acts as a kind of impromptu air conditioner. So as we're getting into those summer months, as we're making preparations here at DEM, definitely make preparations in your home. Again, I know not everyone has the resources to be able to go out and buy a system, but you can make cooling arrangements in your home for just about $20. So look into that. You can read up on ways on how to keep your home cool. Doing things like closing the blinds, keeping the windows open at night to let the cool air in, then closing your windows during the day to keep to let the cool air in. Keep it in during the day when it's hotter out. So there are some ways and some strategies you can help make your home a little bit more comfortable as well. I definitely encourage folks to prepare themselves, and then we'll look to make that resource available when that's no longer an option. So again, it's March right now. We hopefully have a few more months of this cool, wet weather before we get into heat and fire season. So we'll be making preparations here. We'll be make sure to communicate that again via Nixle, via the county Facebook page, etc. When those resources do pop up. But in the meantime, definitely encourage folks to take charge of your own disaster preparedness, as we like to preach here. And hopefully we'll all be a little bit more ready come next summer.
I was going to say, add a HEPA filter to that box fan, and then you can prepare for smoke and COVID.
Yep, exactly. Thank you. Thank you.
Willie, did you really just say, hopefully we're going to have a few more weeks of cold, wet weather?
I did. I
have to push back a little bit on that.
You can quote me on that. Yeah.
And right, we're Northwestern people. Cold and wet is our norm. We like this.
I don't know about that, but are we still hovering around the 80% of snowpack in terms of our summer water supply?
Yep. We're still right around there. We did get a little bit of a boost in recent weeks. There was some higher elevation snow. We're fortunately not at drought level, unlike much of the American West. So when you go in and look at those maps, we are a nice little sliver of white in the Pacific Northwest, among the red and the yellows, where a lot of places are far below their regular rain and regular water table level. So we're still a little bit below normal on snowpack, but not quite at drought phase. But again, we've seen every fire season, if not as bad as the last, worse than the last. So again, that's why I know folks want to get to the warm weather, want to get out of the rain, but that rain is very, very helpful and very, very needed for us to avoid worsening fire season. So again, we're still slightly below normal in snowpack, but still have maybe a couple more weeks of the rainy season in front of us.
Yeah. I'll dig deep to support that. It's not gonna be easy, but I'll try to support your messaging there.
So I think it's a great, you said the word fire a couple times, and I think it's a great opportunity to, since we have a little bit of time, to remind people, let people know that we passed a new ordinance regarding fireworks last week. And it is not an all-out ban on fireworks. I've received so many comments about us banning fireworks all full on. And I'm like, no, we're not banning fireworks. But what we are doing, or what we did do, is give local fire districts more control and authority over banning fireworks by lowering the threshold by which they can ban fireworks from extreme to high danger. So just lowering that, that it's like a thermometer. You often see like low, medium, high, very high, extreme. So our threshold for banning fireworks was at extreme. And so what we did is we provided them the opportunity to institute a ban in the local fire district region if the fire danger was high. And some of the feedback we got from the different fire districts was that, you know, it can be a lot different conditions in Brennan than, say, in Port Townsend. And they wanted to have more ability to have a local response. The ordinance made a few other changes as well, and you're welcome to look at that on our last week's agenda, the March 14th agenda on the commissioner's page. But I just wanted to take this opportunity while there were a few extra people on the call today, just to let people know that we had made that new ordinance and that we look forward to seeing how that works for our local fire districts going forward. There are a lot of concerns. I would say 90% of the public comments we got over the course of the last, I don't know, has it been 6 weeks we've been working on this, were people who frankly wanted an all-out ban on fireworks. And we got a few comments of people who didn't. And we also got some really constructive input as we went through the process of developing the ordinance. And I think we came out with a really good product. So anyway, I just wanted to take this opportunity, because you said fire a couple times, to remind people that that change had just happened. And that ordinance cannot take effect until next year, 2023, as a result of the state law that oversees fireworks or laws. So it will not be in effect until March of 2023. Anyway, that's my little PSA for this morning. I don't know if you have any thoughts on those changes, Willie, or.
No, I mean, I think it's much needed, and I appreciate you hearing out our local fire districts and helping to make that change. You know, obviously, as we talk about the drought and the potential for fire danger there, much of the wildfires that are started are human caused, whether it be fireworks, parking in tall grass, and the heat from the vehicle lighting that dry grass they've parked in, whether it's a spark being thrown from a lawnmower, from a chain dragging from a trailer. There are a lot of ways that, you know, we cause these major incidents. So anything we can do to take steps to prevent a human-caused mishap, I think is a very positive one. You know, there are things we can't control. Mother Nature, we can't control, you know, dry weather, we can't control a lightning strike, but we can control fireworks usage. So, and we're going to be seeing these fire seasons, they're going to last longer, the damaging fires are going to be more frequent, they're going to be more damaging, and they're going to affect places I'm not historically impacted by wildfires. So if anything we can do to lessen the chance for the loss of life or property, it's a very positive step. So I think putting this into our fire district's hands, they all know what we're doing, they all know what they're doing. They keep an eye on these things very closely. So they have the best interests of the community at heart. So again, I'm very supportive and appreciative of that.
Thank you, great. Anything you wanna add, Kate or Mark, on?
We're going to follow that up with the designation of a county fire marshal.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.